Good morning, everybody. We do not have a quorum yet, but in light of the time constraint, I think we'll get going and then with Chair Davids, and then once we have a quorum, I'll officially call the meeting to order and move the bill. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we'll have you start, and then when the when we have a quorum, I'll just interrupt you, and you know the drill.
Yep. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 2071 is a result of the situation that the City of Lanesboro found themselves in. A little history here, and Madam Chair and members, it would be my intention not to to move the bill, but then to have this hearing and then leave it in committee for a bit, because it would be my intention to work with SHPO and the Historical Society to see if there's some things we can work out before we proceed forward. But I really appreciate you giving us the time to air this issue. I think it's a very important issue. A couple years ago, or a year ago, in the bonding bill, we appropriated money in the bonding bill, signed into law by the governor, for the Lanesboro Dam project. Basically, it was from the dam fund, and that money was appropriated. And then a short time ago, I was made aware that Lanesboro needed more money for their dam. And I said, well, that's not possible because we got money in the bonding bill. There's a local option sales tax in the 2011 tax bill for Lanesboro. Part of that could go for costs for the Lanesboro Dam. Well, we had some estimates. It was $900-some thousand to fix it. And then we find out that because of some SHPO regulations using historic materials and so forth, it greatly increased the cost of the dam. So what this bill does is very simple. It just says renovation of Lanesboro Dam in Fillmore County is not subject to the requirements of or review by the State Historic Preservation Office. So in other words, they could go forward with the estimates that they have to repair that dam. And I'm also thinking about taking this a little bit further. That doesn't have to do with this bill, but one of my degrees is in history, and one of my in my social science degree that has a lot of different things. So I'm a history buff. I love history, and I have a situation in my district where there's another a building project that's being slowed up by SHPO, and that's fine. Nobody's lives, there's no lives at risk. I want to preserve history. But members, when it comes to public safety, I think this legislature really needs to think long and hard about if we're going to be holding up projects that have to do with public safety. We have had engineers tell us that this dam is in great need of repair, and if you don't repair a dam, bad things can happen. And I don't want those bad things to happen in Lanesboro. And so this bill simply says that SHPO requirements are waived so that they can go ahead with the estimates that they have and construct the dam. And again, members, as I said, I would, when you have a quorum, someone can move the bill. But then it would be my intention, as I said, to leave it here because the Historical Society, when they saw this bill, came over and talked to me very quickly, and I want to have further conversations with them in this regard to see if there's something we can work out.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to interrupt you right now. We do have a quorum, so the meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Committee is called to order. And Representative Nelson, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'll move the minutes from the previous meeting of February 1st.
Any corrections or changes to the minutes? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Beard?
Ma'am, I'd like to move House File 2071 to get in front of the committee. Where would you like it to go?
General Register.
Ma'am, I'll move House File 2071, recommend it pass and be referred to the General Register.
So moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And again, I'm all for history. I'm all for preservation of history. But when people's lives are at risk, I think we need to take quick action. And you can see that this can go to other areas. I've received a lot of emails and correspondence from folks that have bridges in their districts that are being held up because of SHPO issues. And I don't like to mess with dams and bridges. I think we need to make sure that they're safe for everyone. With that being said, Madam Chair and members, I have with me Bobby Bickerman, who is the city administrator clerk.
Oh,
Bobby is the city administrator and the clerk of the fine city of Lanesboro. And if she could make a short presentation, and then we'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Okay, welcome to the committee, and if you could just please identify yourself for the tape.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Bobby Bickerman, and I'm the city administrator clerk of the city of Lanesboro. And Lanesboro, as well, is very into the historic preservation. We actually are a CLD city, and so it is very important to us as well. We've been going through this for a few years. We have received a letter from the DNR stating that we need to repair the dam or tear it down, which tearing it down would definitely not be the option we would want. We do create hydropower from the dam, so that is another unique asset for the community and for the entire state and green credit. The issue that came forth is our engineer had three different designs. The first design is right under $1 million, around $960,000. That is to do like a concrete base. I'm trying to talk with my hands. It's like a base behind the dam itself, and you're going to use some stamped concrete to fill in the spaces. That would not be approved, obviously, because it's not using historic materials. Just doing the historic materials on the dam itself brings the project up to $1.5 million. And that's not including the left abutment. The left abutment is the area in front of the canal that controls the hydro unit. That as well would have to be historic based on the regulations. And that brings the project up to $1.74 million, not including dredging and engineering fees. So we're looking at a potential $1.8 million project. And we secured $450,000 from the DNR under the dam fund of the last bonding bill. And we did issue a local sales tax recently that was going to pay for the other half of the project. But now we're looking at another $900,000 to come up with, amongst other projects, water, wastewater, streets, as I'm sure you've heard from many of your communities, the issues that we're facing. So that's kind of why we are here. So I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you. I think we'll break for a few questions, and I know that the Historical Society would like to testify as well. I'll start with Representative Scalzi and then Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I was just curious if it's listed in state documents somewhere as a historic place. Is there a designation given to the dam somewhere?
Ms. Bickerman.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, it is. It's over 100 years old. The dam is 140 years old. I believe by the 100-year rule, the State Historical Society would be able to better say that. But we actually do have a CLG for the entire city, so the dam is a historic structure based on its age and the city itself.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the acronym that Representative Davis is using, SHFO, or can you say what that means so that for the tape, because I think the other viewers may not, or listeners may not understand what that is.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Davis.
State Historic Preservation Office, Representative Nelson. And if I could, all the comments I made about how I want this bill to stay in this committee and be laid over, if the committee could just forget everything I said. And I'd appreciate a vote to get it to the floor. I have talked to the Historical Society, and we will not be pushing it forward without having talked to them and come to some agreement to see how we can make this work. So it would just sit there until there'd be an agreement. But because of time constraints, it's probably best to get it out of here if it passes.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davis, is there a Senate companion then where the committee work could be done that we could line up with if we put this to the register? Just thinking of a process question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Beard. I sent the jackets to send over to Senator Miller.
I'm not sure. I just spoke.
I'll have to look. This has all been pretty quick. So there is a Senate companion that we have had drafted and sent over to the Senate. I can follow up with Chair Beard on that to make sure that he's put it in. I'm not sure if he has or not.
Okay. Any other questions at this time? Okay. Maybe we'll have Mr. Kelleher speak next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, we have some serious concerns with this bill as it's drafted. What it does is it exempts one specific project from a review process that's been in place for 40 years. The review process works. The State Historic Preservation Office, which is the department of the Minnesota Historical Society, does thousands of reviews every year. 90%, 90-something percent of those reviews go through without a problem. So if you were to go down the road of exempting specific projects from that process, then that just takes away the validity of that process. The other thing to say is that this is a federal process. This is dealing with federal laws. When federal expenditures or undertakings are part of the process, then the State Historic Preservation Office, which works with the different agencies of the federal government to follow the federal laws for historic preservation reviews, when there is an undertaking, that federal process takes place. So, I think you all know that you can't really tell the federal government what to do, and that's what would happen in this case. This is a federal undertaking because there's federal money going from the USDA rural development into this project, so it goes into the federal project. There's likely to be other federal activity. I suspect that the Army Corps of Engineers, because this is on a river, would get involved at some point too, to have to pull a Army Corps of Engineers permit, so they would become involved as well. On the specifics of this case, I really appreciate Representative David's willing to not push the bill onto the floor or through the floor until we can get some resolution. The SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Office, has done reviews on this, but really the activity is the responsibility of the federal agency, in this case the United States Department of Agriculture. They're providing the funding. They're required by federal law to fulfill their obligations under federal law for historic preservation with the reviews and whatever activities they may take. We're trying to put the puzzle pieces together with why there isn't enough money for this. We have in our files documents from 2009, 2010 that say 1.7 was needed for the project to do this project according to federal historic preservation standards. So we're trying to figure out what happened between then and now, why there doesn't seem to be enough money. And I think part of our other problem solving is if the city of Lanesboro and the U.S. Department of Agriculture decide that they want to follow the option of preserving the bridge, which I think the community acknowledges is an important part of their, I'm sorry, the dam. If they want to preserve the dam as a historic feature, we'll help them with problem solving on how to pay for it, but it's not the SHPO's responsibility to pay for these things. It's the federal agency and the community's responsibility to put the funding package together. So, again, I appreciate Representative David's willingness to work with us and the federal agency that is responsible for this project. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about the process or what SHPO does.
Okay, I'll let Chair Davids respond. I am interested in your perspective on the safety issue, which did seem like a rather large concern. What do you want to address?
Points,
that?
And
Chair
I, Davids? I swore to myself, Madam Chair, I would not say this, but I have a question for committee members. What did the fish say when it hit the concrete? Damn. Never goes over well. I'm sorry. Okay. Madam Chair and members, we have a meeting set. I have a meeting set up with the Historical Society folks on Monday. So we're going to be these meetings are going to start on Monday. I have been in contact with Congressman Walz's office on this issue, and they're in the investigative stage right now at this point. So I've been working with Congressman Walz's office. I have, Madam Chair and members, I have a real sense of urgency about this bill. This dam has been deemed to be unsafe by engineers, and I'm not going to sit out there and hold this project up for any reason. And like I said, I'm all about history, but if it comes to preserving a bit of history or public safety, I'll pick public safety any day of the week. And so I have a real sense of urgency about this bill, and I think the Historical Society, when the gentleman sitting to my right saw this bill. He did his job very efficiently and was right over my office, and we started the dialogue, and that'll continue. There's a real sense of urgency here. This is a matter of timing, and we can't. I do have to disagree with my friend just a little bit here. He says we can't tell the federal government what to do. I just look at the 10th Amendment. I tell them what to do all the time. We can't tell them what to do.
Thank you.
And whose money is it? Okay. Okay. I just sent my estimates in, so I know the Treasury's up quite a bit. So that being said, if we could get this bill to the floor, as I said, we will continue to work with the Historical Society and SHPO and the USDA and Congressman Walz's office to see if we can come to some resolution.
Thank you. Did you have a comment about the safety issue? That is a concern of mine as well.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not an engineer, so I'm not going to really offer an opinion on whether the dam is in imminent danger. I guess if the structural engineers who have worked on this have said imminent danger, then yeah, we ought to pay attention to that. But I think the review process allows for that. And if there's a structure, whether it's a dam or a bridge or a building that is structurally unsound, I don't think we're going to say that it has to be preserved at all costs. I think that there's flexibility in the process, but that can be part of the conversation, how imminent the danger is. And I guess we've done a standard review on this, and it has not been an issue, but obviously there are concerns about the cost of the project and where the money's going to come from. I think the community of Lanesboro, again, wants to preserve this historic structure. It's a part of their, not only their community's identity, but it's a part of their community's economy, because they depend on tourism, and putting up a concrete dam would detract from their heritage tourism efforts.
Ms. Brickman, if you could just respond briefly, I want to get on to some questions too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we actually, through the DNR, did do a dam inundation study, and what that did, it shows what would happen on a standard day if the dam would collapse, and what would happen during a 100-year or greater flood event. And during the normal day, you would see, obviously, the cement coming down, and it wouldn't probably show as much of a risk. However, it is a high-hazard dam, and at a 100-year flood stage or above, it could risk the property or life downstream and also change the recreational capability of upstream, because there would no longer be a river further up. It would be more like a creek system. So we do have that inundation study available for anyone that wishes to see. And I just wanted to make a quick mention, the original funding through the, we are trying to get a low-interest loan through the USDA, and that's where the federal agency comes involved. And I did ask if that would be the same if we did not go through them, which there would still be steps to take, and we understand that completely. The 1.7 was a different type of project that was preserving it as an arch dam. We actually are turning it into a gravity structure dam, because there's no longer the rock structure to hold the arch dam at its existing level. So there are some changes in the project, and that was with $450,000 of engineering fees included in that original USDA grant, but we have redone it. So,
okay. All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She answered my question about the health. I had a question about the health and safety. If it were to go out today, what you're saying, what health problems or safety problems are we downstream? And she answered all those questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davids, what would happen if you just did it and then said you're sorry?
Representative Davids,
well,
how do you
I've
feel about the ask for apology
Erdahl,
rather than permission?
Sometimes it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, yeah. But I don't think we really want to go there on this. And Madam Chair and members, if you look at District 31B, 2007 in August with the Rushford floods and the flooding around Hoka and all the landslides and everything, I get a little touchy when it comes to flooding, and I want to avoid it at all costs.
Representative Scalzi.
I just have a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has nothing to do with your project, but we were in the bonding committee yesterday, and we learned that there's 800 dams in Minnesota, either on public property. They're public dams. The DNR is in charge of like 400 of them, and most of them are over 50 years old. And I'm just kind of just cautioning the committee and maybe people who are here that know more about it than I do. This is a problem we're going to come up with in the future, because, and most of those dams were created to make lakeshore property. That was the testimony yesterday. Most of those 800 dams were created to create lakeshore property for somebody. It's just an interesting sidebar tidbit, but I think it's something we're going to be looking at, because some of these are really, really old, and I would think might fall under the same type of snafu catch-22. And I understand what you're going through. I'm hoping that there is something that we can do because you need the money from the USDA, and the USDA has the requirements. So I think we're kind of caught in the middle here. I'm not sure what we can do in the state.
Okay. Is there anyone else that needs to testify in the bill? Questions? Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just do a little problem solving here because I think that Mr. Kelleher raises a really important point about the precedent that this sets. But I also understand Representative David's, you know, interest in, you know, resolving this issue for the community there. I always get a little nervous when we say, well, let's just pass this and then we'll, you know, figure it out later. What would be the timeline, Representative David's, you know, to get there's some moving parts here. You're trying to get some money. I think that's the key thing from the federal government and the agencies. You started some preliminary conversations with Congressman Walz. What's your understanding of, you know, how long it'll take to get some answers?
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. I think we will probably be able to sort a lot of this out on Monday. We have a meeting set up Monday. We won't have all the parties there, but we'll get a much clearer understanding as to the direction we should be taking. So it's in preliminary. I really don't have, you know, if we, you know, send this out to the floor, we're not going to move on it on the floor. I'm not going to request that it be brought up until we've had some agreements that we come to, because if, you know, we're not going to be able to get this passed and have it do anything if we don't have agreements to make it work. So, but I'd say if we can get it out of here today, and I'll continue to work on it throughout the session.
Okay. Senator Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, it seems like there's two issues. I mean, one is that, you know, probably fixing some of the language that so that the Historical Society wouldn't view this as a precedent that then everybody could just follow and, you know, dispense with some of their other really important criteria for this. And then there's the money piece. So I don't know. I feel a little uncomfortable. We've had a hearing, so we could probably very quickly pass this after Monday. But you know, it's ultimately up to the committee, and I trust both of you. You're great people, and I know it'll get worked out. But it still feels a little bit nebulous to me.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, I appreciate your comments there. You know, the other approach, someone said I should probably take, is just put a bill in to make the balance and just pay for it. Well, this gets to be a bigger issue than just throwing some more money at it, because when we're talking about public safety and bridges and other dams around the state, I think it's something we need to have the discussion on. And as I said, it's not going to do me any good to move this forward if we don't have agreement on it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davids, I like the idea that we're having this discussion because there are so many of these small dams around. One in my district, there was a flooding, and we lost Lake Shady. The dam itself was still functional. The flood water sort of washed the bank around when the levels got high, and there wasn't any recourse to looking at, you know, maintaining that, the history, et cetera, of that dam, because it was an automatic, you know, veto by the DNR. And I always felt that we needed some discussion. And I hope that this is a vehicle to allow for that broader discussion, broader understanding for, you know, the other dams that are around. So that's why I'm for this. And I'm really happy that you're looking at having additional discussion afterwards and working this. Because, you know, this is an issue that isn't huge unless it's that dam that generations have grown up with in their small town, which I still have a couple.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Looks like we're about ready to move on for a vote. So with that, Representative Beard renews his motion that House file 2071 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail, and I'll trust that you'll work it out before we see it on the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I'd just like to welcome to the committee the Elk River Chamber of Commerce Leadership Program. Right down the road from me, I'm Stephen Rogers. Thank you. Next on the agenda is House File 2082, Representative Crawford. Welcome to the committee. Would you like your bill moved before we start?
Sure.
Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2082 and be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
So moved. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative Roger Crawford, I represent District 8B in the State House here. House File 2082 concerns the city in my district, Sandstone. They own a housing project, and they would like to sell the housing project to a private developer. And I brought along today Sam Griffith, who is the city administrator for Sandstone. He'll explain the project, why they want to do it. And after Mr. Griffith is done, we do have a couple folks that made the trip down from Sandstone that have some reservations about the project. So we'd like to have them a chance to give their opinion and stand for some questions.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sam Griffith. I am the city administrator for the city of Sandstone, as well as the executive director of the Sandstone PDA. What we're requesting basically is an exemption to part of state law that basically says if a project has general obligation funding, as long as any of those bonds are outstanding, either the authority must be the owner or there has to be a limited partnership in which the authority would be the managing partner. Let me give you a little quick history. Back in 1994, the EDA issued a series of three tax-exempt bonds for a total of a little over $5 million for the purpose of building 72 units of rental housing, 36 townhome units with detached garages for families and a three-story, 36-unit senior project with underground parking. The EDA pledged the general obligation of the city for additional security. Please note, there's no subsidy here. There's no federal money. There's no state money in this. This was strictly a EDA project. We did refund the bonds in 2004. The basic problem we have is that we've had real difficulty in keeping the project fully rented. To the extent where, because of the general obligation requirement, the city's had to levy for the last four or so years $150,000 to make good the shortfall in the debt service. Let me put that $150,000 in perspective. Our total levy proposed, our total levy for 2012 is $445,000. So basically one-third of our levy is going to make up this debt service. Plus the fact that even if we were 100% occupied, we would not break even. And I could go into all the details in regards to that. Basically what we have is we still owe about $4.2 million, but the value actually is only about 2.6. Please understand that's not the appraised value yet. We haven't had the appraisal done. We obviously have looked at it from an income standpoint for those purposes. The other problem that we have is, once again, this was built in 1994, so we're entering our 18th year of service. There are some deferred maintenance issues. One of the issues is that we have a repair and replacement fund, which we fund out of the rents. At the current time, we have about $96,000 in that fund, and we put in about $14,000 a year. We worked with our marketing company and an engineer, and we looked at if we were to bring the buildings up to code. And part of the reason we're talking about this is obviously if we put new windows and doors in, there's energy savings, which reduce operating costs. There's some original carpet that's still in, those kind of things. We looked at it, And we estimated that it would cost about $1.2 million if we were to do everything at one time. The buyer that's come forward has looked at it, and he estimates about $1.1 million in improvements. So part of the issue we have here is because of the general obligation debt, there's $3 million of outstanding obligations. We can't issue any additional debt against the property above and beyond that $3 million, so we wouldn't be able to add any additional debt until we pay down that $3 million. Well, that takes us into 2023. So part of the problem we're faced here is if we do need to do some kind of a major improvement, or even if we would like to, or if we had to, we have no way of financing that. Basically, we have a private developer who stepped forward. This particular developer does these kinds of projects, acquires them, rehabs them, and operates them. He would use private financing as well as tax credits. And what he's looking at doing is basically he would put about $1.1 million into this. What's interesting about this is that, once again, if he does this with the tax credits, basically he's going to have to guarantee that the project stays affordable for an additional 30 years. And actually what would happen is the rents would go down. Basically the rents would go down by about $100 a month per unit. And obviously if you do those improvements, you reduce the operating costs. And once again, what this does is then ensure the long-term affordability of the project. So what we're looking to do, basically, at this point in time, we have not made a final decision as to whether or not we're going to sell. Obviously, because the developer needs some approvals, he's got to go in and get his tax credits, we have to do an appraisal, those kind of things. But we don't want to spend our time, we don't want to spend his time and money, because without this exemption from state law, basically we can't sell it, because his private financing, obviously, they're going to require he has full ownership. And the way the state law is, we have to either stay the owner, or in a limited partnership, we would have to be the controlling partner. So it basically does us no good. So this is why we are requesting your consideration of this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nelson, you had a question?
Madam Chair, I've got a couple of questions, or a series of them. I think you answered part of this. Currently, it's low income, and you're saying that if it's going to stay low income if this new buyer takes it over, or is it going to be converted to market share? And I think you said it's going to stay low income, but I'd like you to answer that question. And I guess the other question is how many years outstanding more do you have to pay it off if you do not sell it? So I guess answer those first two, in fact.
Mr. Griffith?
The current project is low and moderate income, and primarily it is moderate income. If the private developer buys it with tax credits, there is a basic level of income that you have to have in order to qualify to live there. So it would actually become more affordable with the private owners. Because right now, our only source of revenue to pay our bills are the rents. The other question related to, currently the outstanding debt goes to 2029. There's outstanding revenue bonds, which get paid first out of revenues. The last payment on those is in 2018, and then we would start paying on the general obligation debt in 2019.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Nelson?
Not right now, no.
Does anybody else have a question? And then I know we have a person or two. Representative Green.
Thank you. I wondered, my follow-up is the possible buyer required to preserve it, or I'm sorry, required to take the tax credit and maintain it as low to moderate income housing, or can they decide not to?
Mr. Griffith.
Not being an expert on low-income tax credits, my understanding is that if you take the credits, basically you sign an agreement that it will, if you get, basically, yeah, they do have to preserve it as low-moderate income.
Representative Green.
I'm sorry, I just want to clarify my own question. Are they definitely taking the tax credits?
Mr. Griffith.
Yes, if that is would be their proposed financing, that's how they would pay for it, yes.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm wondering then, it sounds to me like this is not going to work. If it's, it just seems to me that it's not going to work. But if this proposed buyer then defaults, then what would happen to the low and moderate income requirement?
Mr. Griffith?
My understanding how it works, if the current owner would default, someone else would step in and continue. Because I have to plead, you know, some ignorance in how the tax credits do work, but I'm understanding that that is something that goes with the property, and if the current buyer would have problems, someone would have to step in, but still preserve the low and moderate nature of the units.
Do you have a follow-up question? Okay, any other questions at this time? Okay, maybe Irene Sandell and Stacy Carpenter. Oh, no. Wayne Oak and Irene Sandell. Come down. They wanted to testify some concerns, I believe. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Wayne Oak, resident of Sandstone for the last 45 years, and I guess my biggest concern, I've sat on the city council also for a few years. I just think that at this point, we're asking for something that we really don't know where we want to be going on. And if you just look at just some general figures, we still owe $4.some million. We sell it for 2.8, and yet we still then have to pay off that difference over the next 16, 17 years. And I think that's a concern that we have is that at this point we have some issues with it. We understand that. As we go along and we start having to pay off the rest of the bond and for $120,000 a year, Mr. Griffith talked about having that cost us $150,000 a year now for subsidy. Well, we're still going to be subsidizing that bond for the next 16, 17 years, and at the end, we have nothing in it. If we continue to work on it and try to make it more profitable and pay the money, at least we would probably have, you know, a little something in our back pocket when we get done with it. And so I guess there are both of us here speak for a number of people from Sandstone who feel that this is being rushed. We don't really have a good understanding, and so at this point we're really opposed to the idea of having this bill. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And Ms. Sandell, if you could identify yourself and then proceed to testify.
Thank you. Irene Sandell, and I'm also a former council member. I also have relatives living in each of these buildings who are very happy with where they are living. We also, my husband and I, have two rental properties, and having had these facilities come in, we were quite concerned, wondering how that was going to affect us, and it didn't. It's been a positive effect on the community, and I was surprised to hear this called low and moderate income, because we look at these facilities as being moderate, or even for our community, upper income facilities. It has brought in people who otherwise couldn't find a decent rental property in Sandstone, and it did take us much longer to fill up these facilities than what we had hoped for. But now we are, I think, at about 95% capacity, and it's exciting to see that, and that's just happened in the last year. And as I understand, more people are looking for renting than they are for housing, and there isn't rental property in Sandstone. So I think it's very prime. And if we were going to sell it, why then are we not advertising and looking for a buyer, a more competitive buyer? And tax credits are mentioned. Does this mean that we will not be getting full taxes from these facilities? Then why, you know, what's the advantage of selling? And the properties seem to be in very good condition. Yes, they could be made more weather efficient. But I like Wayne says, I think that we can do some of these things. I don't think our management company has been on top of things, and I realize we're a small rental unit compared to what the management company does handle. But is, we have also asked, is that something that could be done locally? We also have asked about what the appraised actual value of these buildings are. We have not had that information. So I think there needs to be more study done on this before we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone have any questions for the witnesses? Representative Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either of the testifiers, having both of you, I believe, said you've served on the council.
Correct.
Has this been a tough investment for the past 18 years then? And,
yes.
And I guess my question then is, what have we done to address that over the 18 years to get to the point where we're at now?
Ms. Hendel.
I think the management company has not been as proactive on advertising and letting people know about what we have in this facility and also in the community. And I think just economic circumstances have changed things. So more people are looking for renting, and there just isn't nice rental property in Sandstone.
Madam Chair, just two more quick ones.
Representative Murray.
Is the current board, the current city council, in favor of this project then, in favor of selling this?
I think they haven't come to the point where they want to say they want to sell. They did vote 4-1 that the issue should be brought up so they could talk about it. I don't think, I can't say what came to the actual vote, what they would do.
I'm not so sure either.
Mr. Griffith?
No. I'm not so sure
either. Excuse me, Mr. Hope.
If they're full, you know, if it was a vote right now, if the full council would vote for it, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think it may pass, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Griffith, did you have anything to add? Do you know?
Only for discussion.
Okay.
And just the last comment, then,
Madam
Chair, I think this bill basically makes it permissive for the city to do this. So we're still talking about giving you local control to go back and make that decision within your city, if I'm correct.
Correct.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Scalzi.
I guess I'm just concerned about setting a precedent, and I'm wondering if maybe Ms. Dyson would know. And I'm sure you don't. You might have to research it. But how many of these types of, I'm sorry to insult you. How many of these types of questions could we be faced with if we set a precedent here? I'm just assuming that there's quite a few cities that have done this in the past. And I'm just wondering if there's a flood of this possibly.
Ms. Dyson, do you have any information for us?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I think you were correct when you said, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
That's fine. Representative Scalzi.
I'm just wondering, is it hundreds? Is it thousands? Is it? That's, and we don't know. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a tough one. Looking at this, and as Representative Scalzi said, that the setting a precedent that we have might have a whole flood of different cities coming forward that have made these investments. I mean, on the surface, looking at this and having worked in public housing in the past, it's torn because are we getting rid of low-income housing and can we, and I guess my question is, why can a private developer or owner do a better job of managing this, or are we as the city of Sandstone trying to just dump a bad investment in real and cut our losses? I mean, so we don't have to do the maintenance and repair, the deferred maintenance and repair that's there. That's money that we're going to save, even though we end up losing money on what we do with this and still have the obligation. And you know, sometimes as a businessman, you make those decisions. You take a loss, figuring, I don't want it. It's just going to take more money in the future. So I'm torn on this. I can see reasons why, but I don't know if they're rushing it. I agree that with that the language is permissive, but again, the precedent that we set by doing this is that we're going to have a whole flood of these coming from other cities around the state that have made the same type of investment for housing in their community, and now they want to dump them also. And so I guess that's what I'm concerned on this.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look at the precedents being a little bit different. We allow cities to go in and try things, and they aren't always going to succeed. And so if the precedence is if you try something and it's not succeeding, we're not going to let you out of it, we might inhibit people being, you know, open and aggressive to trying something to help their community. However, if we say, you know, we understand that not everything's going to work, and that we're going to allow for you at a future time when it comes more fully that it's not going to work, to come to us and have an out, I think that might make it easier for people to be aggressive in looking at ways to helping, because Greater Minnesota has a lot of issues, and those issues tend to be very localized. And by allowing creativity and flexibility in the local government end, I think we can better fulfill and satisfy the citizens of those communities than being too drastic here and not letting them. So I'm for allowing this, because I think it actually will prompt more activity and more assistance to the citizens by showing that we do listen, and if times change, we will allow you to make that better decision that you have come to.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just wish that we had someone from the current city council here to let us know how they feel about this. I'm a little concerned that we would, I guess, you know, coming from local government, I'm just concerned that we would pass a bill that would allow this, and maybe it's the wrong way to go if the current city council is not in favor of it. Usually when we deal with issues like this, we have the current city council has passed a resolution and asking us to help them do what they want to do. I don't see that here, and that concerns me.
Representative Crawford, I see Mr. Griffin wants to
reply. Yeah, Chair, thank you. And Mr. Griffin, maybe we could address that point.
I mean, I would say, too, just remind everyone that this is permissive, so they wouldn't be required if they didn't indeed. So I'm a little less concerned about that, but we'll put Mr. Griffith, and maybe he can shed some more light onto the current council.
Madam Chair, members, what you have to understand is what the current city council is doing is they're trying to look at all their options. And as I said before, they have not made a final decision, but without this legislation, there is a door closed to them that they can't consider. Once again, I could give you some numbers that said if we don't sell it and we don't do the improvements, here's the impact that it'll have on the levy through 2029. If we refinance it and don't do the improvements, here's what we think would happen with the levy to 2029. Here's what would happen to the levy if we refinanced and then in 2023 took on additional debt to do those improvements, you know, what the impact would have on the levy. So if we look at it purely from a levy standpoint, one of the options from the city is if we can work out a sale, which hasn't been done yet, the impact on the levy is less than any of those other options. Second of all, even if we sell it, the property's not going away. There is the 30-year obligation to keep it low and moderate income. There's $1 million investment put into the property to make it more energy efficient and everything, and the rents go down. So basically, we have still accomplished the original purpose for constructing the project in the first place, providing affordable housing. and doing it in what hopefully is a, you know, is in a way that makes some economic sense, and reducing the long-term liability of the city, because at this point in time, you know, as I stated, we can't take on any additional debt until we reduce that general obligation debt, and we don't start paying on that general obligation debt until 2019. So by the time we pay that down so that we could borrow a half a million or a million, we're suddenly in, if we were to borrow a million, we would have to wait until 2023. What are the interest rates going to be? And then all of a sudden, now we're going to have $3 million in debt again at the new interest rate. What impact is that going to have on the rents, the affordability, you know, those kind of things. Please understand, this is not an easy, this is no easier for my council than it is for you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll?
Madam Chair, Mr. Griffin has answered a number of the points to kind of summarize those. I would just ask him, you are not here on your own volition, you are here authorized by your council to explore options. Am I correct on that?
Correct. Mr. Griffith?
Correct.
Madam Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll?
Have you explored the issues associated with, since you talked about where you refunded this in your issue in 94, you refunded that in 04?
Correct.
Mr. Griffin,
do you have prepayment penalties on that you have to factor on this as well, because you no longer own that asset?
Mr. Griffin,
typically when you issue bonds, there are call provisions put in, which basically said, for example, in 2004, there was a seven-year call, which meant we couldn't prepay for 7 years. So now in 2011, when that call provision no longer is there, that's why we're having this kind of discussion. We're also looking at refinancing and hopefully putting in a shorter call date if we decide not to sell, or, for example, the buyer can't get tax credits. We would refinance. Let's say we can do this, say, for put in a call provision for 5 years, revisit this again. It still comes back to the issue. At some point in time, one of the options that we do need to consider is whether or not we're better off as a community to sell the property. And without this exemption from the law, that's not an option available to us.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, we do have several more things on the agenda, so if we could keep our questions and responses brief, that'd be helpful. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, my basically, yeah, just yes or no, just to make sure that I 360'd the issue. And what I'm hearing is, instead of it being in the hands of Sandstone, you're going to put it into a private developer who's going to do the same exact thing. No one's being displaced. No one's being evicted from the units. They're, as a matter of fact, going to be able to make improvements that you're unable to financially make at this point because of the structure and so forth of the financing and status of the property. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Griffith?
That is correct.
And you also indicated that you're levying about $150,000 more on all taxpayers in the community to be able to help subsidize the project, and you see that coming down, which would have an impact on your overall property taxes that people would pay in the community as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Griffith?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Does anyone else have additional questions? If not, we'll take it to a vote here. Ms. Sandell, if you could keep it brief. Thank you.
I would just like to have a point clarified by Sam on this, that there's no changes. The status will stay as is. The senior building will stay senior building. The other will be family building. And there will not be subsidized parties living there.
Okay.
I can answer that.
Mr. Griffith, I'm really trying to move on. I think we're about ready for a vote here. If you need to answer briefly, that'd be fine.
I can answer to Ms. Sandell directly.
Okay. Representative Crawford, did you need to close up here? Any closing thoughts?
No, very, very good, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity, and I feel like as a representative, I have an obligation to follow ahead with what the cities in my district would like to do. Thank you very much.
All right, Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I'd renew my motion that this House file be moved to the General Register. Passed and moved to the General Register.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Thank you. And at this time we're going to move on to House File 1926. I think that'll move a little quicker. Representative Swidzinski.
Is
Welcome to the committee, and I'll have Representative Murray move your bill. Representative Murray?
Madam Chair, I would recommend that House File 1926 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
Thank you. To your bill.
Chair, members, laid out in this bill are requirements and procedures necessary for the voluntary attainment of a good manufacturing practices certificate for commercial feed and feed ingredients issued by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Federal rules on GMPs are in the process of being adopted, which will then be incorporated by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for Minnesota through Section 4 of this bill. Section 4 authorizes the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to adopt the federal rules without additional hearing at the state level. And it, since the rules have already kind of gone through process of the, at the national level, Subdivision 15 and Section 1 of this bill allows for the redundant provisions of this bill to be eliminated when the federal rules are adopted. This is technically kind of a stopgap or a temporary bill that would allow businesses within the state that are looking to do export to countries that have adopted some of these good manufacturing processes as a contingent of feed that is being manufactured within the United States to be exported to those countries. And so the issue is that the feds simply have not come up with their programs. The FDA, with their Food Modernization Act, kind of is a broad-reaching reform nationwide, and being so broad, they have yet to kind of catch up with the application of those rules, the creation of those rules. This allows Minnesota businesses that are looking to export to foreign countries, Brazil, potentially Mexico, to move forward with potential sales. This is a jobs bill that allow Minnesota manufacturers to capture market share internationally, hopefully ahead of other states so that we can compete on a global level. So with that, basically that's what the bill does. It's going to be a temporary bill. It's the fees that are going to be associated with this bill, because the Department of Agriculture has not had prior approval to do anything like this. This is a new deal. In the budget, there are so all the costs associated with this inspection is voluntary. So as a business is looking to bring in the Department of Ag to do the certification, the simple cost of doing the inspection will be covered by the folks asking for the inspection. So.
Okay. Looks like there's somebody there to testify.
Yes.
Would you please identify yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gothier. I'm with the Department of Agriculture. I'm here to answer questions. And we have worked with Representative Swazinski on this bill in response to some Minnesota companies that came forward to both their legislators and the department asking for assistance regarding a trade requirement recently adopted by the country of Brazil that impedes the ability of Minnesota companies that are exporting non-medicated feed for commercial sale to comply. As Representative Swazinski said, we're in kind of a gap right now between a major new federal overhaul of the food code, the rules for which have not yet come out, but we expect them to come in the middle of this year sometime. So until that point, we have no authority to certify that the manufacturing processes for this type of feed meet certain criteria that are set forth in the bill. This would put up a temporary system to allow the department to inspect on request, that means it's voluntary, the feed of companies that are seeking to export to Brazil, and now apparently the Dominican Republic has put up a similar trade requirement and Mexico is about to. This will help those Minnesota companies meet the requirement that's been imposed by these foreign companies until such time as the Food and Drug Administration comes down with final rules for this type of feed, which we at the Department of Agriculture would then, through this bill, adopt those rules by reference. And that's something that we commonly do with food rules coming down from the FDA.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? Is there anyone else that would like to testify to the bill? Oh, sorry, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, what kind of cost are we looking at for the for a company? What kind of fee are we looking at? Do we have an idea what it's going to cost for them if they want to get certified?
Ms. Gaithier?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, this is something that is a type of inspection our department has never done before. We have done something similar for medicated feed for commercial sale, but not for non-medicated feed. So we don't know exactly what it's going to cost. We anticipate and estimate right now that it'll be about $1,200 per inspection. That's for the work at the manufacturing facility, as well as the paperwork that has to be done back in the office and the travel time and mileage, et cetera, for that, for each inspection. And it will be on request.
Thank you, Madam. That's what I need. It gives me a ballpark figure.
Any additional questions? I think we're perhaps ready for a vote then. Representative Murray? Would you like
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that this bill, House File 1926, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Nay. Motion does prevail. Next on the agenda is House File 1812.
Representative Stensrud, welcome to the committee. I would like to move your bill, House File 1812, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Please proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I had a chance to meet yesterday afternoon with the Department of Administration. I have a small oral amendment I'd like to offer on this before I move forward.
Okay, Representative Sensrud, go ahead with your oral amendment.
On line 1.14 and 1.15, it refers to purchase or lease of a waste hauling vehicle. I would like to delete both of those lines. It was not my intention to really micromanage the Department of Administration, and it turns out that they no longer have an operational garbage truck, and they are on a rental agreement right now. So I'd like to strike or delete those two lines.
Okay. Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, I will move the oral amendment to delete lines 1.14 and 1.15 from the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Yes, I'd like to recognize Mr. Shepherd. There are a couple technical changes that we need to look at also.
Mr. Chair, members of Representative Stensrud, there are just a couple of conforming changes in some of the head notes that would go along with deleting subdivision 2 online. And I do have this all written up for Ms. Hansen. I'll give it to her afterwards. But on page 1, lines 8 and 9, you delete the words vehicle acquisition prohibited from that head note. And then on page 1, line 10, you would delete the where it says subdivision 1 and then the bold heading waiver. Because there wouldn't be, there'd only be one subdivision in this section. And then the, as Representative Stensrud indicated, lines 14 and 15 would be deleted entirely. And then we would amend the title on lines 4 and 5 to delete the phrase prohibiting the state from purchasing waste hauling vehicles for use in the Capitol complex. And I do have that in written form for Ms. Hansen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Shepherd. You incorporate that into your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to incorporate that into the oral amendment.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions on the amendment? Representative Kwong.
Mr. Chair, is my understanding that on 1.4, since it's all deleted, that you are also deleting to do the work?
Maybe we should ask Mr. Shepherd to clarify that, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwong, on line 1.4, you would only delete the language after the semicolon, starting with prohibiting. Thank you. Now, make sure that gets done correctly.
Okay. Is that clarified? Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Okay. Opposed? Motion or the amendment is approved. Representative Stenzer, go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I brought this a bill similar to this last year to the committee, and there were some other agency interests regarding the recycling and things that I really hadn't begun to introduce, but put them on, and it sort of confused the issues. So this is a much cleaner version of what I had hoped to accomplish last session. Currently, here at our state office complex, we have evidently a few other buildings where we collect our own garbage. And just a little background, back in college, I actually was a garbage man for a couple of years. So I appreciate the hard work it is and have a little bit of understanding of the job. But I found it to be kind of confusing that we would actually have our own garbage truck for the state capitol complex and some of the different buildings we have around here. It didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, knowing some of my background. So there are about 17 stops that are collected, that garbage gets collected at, and evidently you have a couple of good state employees who do that work, but it's not a full-time work. They work a few hours a day and accomplish this. It's not my intention to get rid of employees, but I think this bill will allow the Department of Administration to have freedom and flexibility in future years to consider as an option to outsource or to hire an actual professional, you know, garbage hauling service to take care of our needs here at the state office complex. So if it makes sense to do that in future years, there really shouldn't be a law that prohibits that and limits the options to the management team. So that's really what this bill will accomplish, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there currently a law that prohibits analyzing outsourcing versus using our own state employees?
Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scalzi. I don't think there's a law prohibiting the analyzing, but I think they may not make that decision to make any changes. That's my understanding.
Follow-up, Representative Scalzi.
So then you think there's a law that prevents them from outsourcing currently if they wanted to?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, yes, it's my understanding that we would need a waiver to 16C for this particular service that we're doing. So, and in talking with the department yesterday, I know it's not an option. And as a little bit of background, they had an aging vehicle, an aging garbage truck. So last year, I thought, boy, I didn't really want to invest in a brand new garbage truck here for a state capitol. I didn't think that made sense. But since then, that truck has expired and is no longer serviceable. So then there was no option. They had to get another vehicle. So they're on a month-to-month agreement with the city of St. Paul, and they have some kind of a garbage truck that they're renting. Okay. and using for this purpose today.
Representative Scalzi, I'm going to ask Mr. Shepard to maybe clarify that a little further for you. Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scalzi, on page 1, line 10 of the bill, it references section 16C.09, part of which says that before entering into a service contract, the Commissioner of Administration must determine that no current state employee is able and available to perform the services. And section 43A.047 has a similar requirement.
All right. Any additional questions? Okay, I believe we have one testifier in the audience, Julie Blyle. If you'd like to approach. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We are here today in opposition to the bill. It was interesting to hear the comments that Representative Stenzer had made at the beginning. And with all due respect, if you don't want to micromanage, you would not be moving forward with this bill. The two members that are impacted are also here today, Jeff Morgan and Pat McClone, as well as Maynard Stavina from the Department of Administration. And this is not a new issue. As Representative Stensrud indicated, he came forward with this issue last year. And I think there's a lot of questions that need to be asked. One that comes to mind immediately is the security of material, given the type of material that is sometimes floating around both the state office building and the Capitol, whether or not we want a private company in charge of removing that material. But most importantly, I think we need to ask the question of why are we attacking our public employees and saying that we want to outsource the service. Chapter 16C is something that I have worked on for many, many years, and it's there for a purpose. It's there to protect our employees when they are available and able to do the job. And it was indicated that, you know, they don't collect or pick up waste all day long, but they do work all day long. They multitask. They do many functions. And I am here today to oppose this bill and hope that this bill does not move forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier or any additional testifiers in the audience? Hearing none, Representative Stensrud, any closing comments on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess I would just offer a slightly different perspective, is that the 16C provision that exists in our statutes today does exactly that. It's micromanaged, and it does prevent the Department of Administration from doing in future years what might be the best business practice for that department. So by doing nothing, we take away an option. We just passed a bill prior to mine where you're looking at some local control and allowing an option to be considered by a city council. And I think this is an option we would like to give the Department of Administration. It's not a mandate to do something immediately. It's just going to allow provision in future years if this is the best way for the department to take care of business, that we allow them to do that. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stensrud. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1812, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Aye. Motion carries. Bill is passed.
Okay. My intention at this time is to start Representative Kahn's bill. She has a special guest I will have her introduce. And we'll probably, depending on time, lay it over and take it up later. But Representative Kahn, if you could come up, and I will move that House File 2007 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on State Government Finance. And if you could just perhaps start by introducing your special witness, that would be great.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members. This is a very simple study bill, so it's one paragraph that you can see. Testifying today, Antonio Ocelli, if that's the right pronunciation, may be familiar to some of you because he was the facilitator at the cross-jurisdictional workshop at the One Minnesota Conference. And he's presently commuting between here and Harvard and is here this week, so I was able to invite him to come to talk on the issue of cross-jurisdictional consolidation, which this bill addresses. So I'd like to introduce Professor, Mr. Whatever, Doctor.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ocelli. If you could again state your name, because we need it for the tape, and then begin your testimony. And thank you for coming here today.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair Pepin and committee members. My name is Antonio Ocelli.
Executive Director of Leadership for Network World and a Fellow at the Technology and Entrepreneurship Center at Harvard, and a Hennepin County resident and homeowner and Minnesota taxpayer, of course. So just wanted to come and advocate for the passing of this this bill, and would like to just give a little bit of perspective on this type of bill, answering questions you might have, and then again at the end just advocate for the actions you could take. We've been studying at the university and around the nation the cross-jurisdiction collaboration, essentially a model in which public service organizations and their partners work across traditional jurisdictional boundaries to provide current or future services in order to save money or provide better service levels. I think the one interesting thing that we've learned in Minnesota is that we have no clear idea right now on how much money could be saved by working across county boundaries. There are some good examples up there of collaboration, but we haven't done much as far as studying the total impact of them. We also don't know how much service levels could be potentially improved by more collaboration. So at a baseline is we need to better understand that and assess it in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to give you just the three quick examples, because I know we're tight on time here, of around the nation of states or regions that have done this. The first one is Joint Venture Silicon Valley, which is a collaboration of about 101 cities and 9 counties, and that composes about 7 million people in Northern California. They, for many years, had a challenge with local government with meeting demands and with cost escalating, as many of our local governments here in Minnesota do. They conducted a study looking at shared services across jurisdictional boundaries, procurement savings, that type of thing, a little bit of consolidation, and found that an estimated $220 million could be saved each year at a very low-impact business model, meaning that no state employees or county employees would be affected purely by savings from efficiencies and economies of scale, but that they could also achieve about $500 million annually in more of a high-impact business model, where they would reorganize some staff and consolidate some positions in counties and cities. So $220 million to $500 million impact in this 9-county, 101 city, 7 million people area in California. Similarly, in Ohio, there's a local government innovation fund, which is the House Bill number 371 in the state of Ohio. What they're doing is they've done a study, found there's the substantial savings in Ohio that could be generated. So they've allocated $45 million for collaboration and shared services amongst political subdivisions, primarily across counties and cities. Of that $45 million, $9 million is available for planning grants, essentially to do studies, smaller studies across counties and localities, and $36 million for actually implementation and startup. So this may be an interesting example for the state of Minnesota and the legislature is how to package up some funding for to pursue these types of developments. In Michigan, they have a Government Technology Innovation Executive Directive 2012-1, which establishes a fund of $2.5 million for the state of Michigan for all executive branch agencies and departments to study local shared services. So again, another state putting money behind the idea that we could generate savings for this type of collaboration. Now, a bill that has a little bit more teeth across the nation is in New Jersey. It's Senate Bill 2794, where they've established essentially a bill that says we must look at how much money could be saved across localities and counties, consolidation and shared services. And if the study shows that savings can be realized through sharing, the question of whether to do so or not will be put to the local level to adopt the model. If towns involved failed to pass the measure, they would then lose all their state aid. Essentially, they lose the state aid that's equal to the amount of savings, I should say. So essentially, they're saying there in New Jersey, we know there's money to be saved. We're going to do studies. If your locality says that we don't want to do this, you'll lose that amount in state aid, the savings that you could have. So interesting teeth to that particular example, a little bit more robust example. So the in general, what we found in researching this is that costs can be reduced. As you talked about, it's not a panacea. It's not a $5 billion savings that the state of Minnesota is going to receive, but there will be substantial savings. As well as services can be improved oftentimes. Many times when local governments are collaborating across boundaries, they can invest a little bit in service delivery, actually bring up a standard delivery while reducing costs. The two key takeaways, I think, for this committee would be that doing an assessment is fundamental to this. We need to have a baseline understanding of what could be saved in Minnesota by consolidation and by some shared services across counties, as well as what the mix or portfolio of those services could be. So, what's imperative now, I think, is this committee move forward with this, advocate for study on this, and see what could be done, at least in the state.
We're running a little short on time, and I wanted to, there was someone that was another person out of town from Beltrami, a Beltrami County Commissioner, that wanted to testify against the bill, and I'd like to get him in so he doesn't have to come back. Did you have questions particularly for Mr. Oftelli?
If we're going to be discussing this later, I can go.
Okay. Talk. Is that Representative Quam?
Madam Chair, I did have a specific question for, have you looked at the collaborative effort of southeastern Minnesota counties for health services in a regional cloud, and if offline you could give some opinion on how that is relational to the kind of projects you're looking for? That's what I'm after from this specific testifier.
Mr. Oftelli?
I do not have any data on that example. I have kind of read about it a bit and talked to some of the people involved in the human services side of that. What I've heard and learned about it is that there is substantial savings and service improvements at play in that region. They can use, for example, common entry systems for human services clients, eligibility systems that can be shared across localities and jurisdictions. Historically, we've had every county, because Minnesota is a county-delivered human services system, so every county tends to develop their own systems and have intake for clients and whatnot. That's siloed, essentially. So this gives an opportunity there to share those resources to develop better systems. There are savings at play there, and I'm not sure how much, but it looks like a good program.
Okay. If it's okay at this time, I'd like to bring in Mr. Venny so that he doesn't have to come back here. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Venny. I'm a Beltrami County Commissioner and the first Vice President of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm honored to join Representative Kahn at the table here. I've admired her long and distinguished service in the legislature on behalf of citizens from all around Minnesota. I would like to simply say, as I look upon Minnesota in general, in particular, northern and northwestern Minnesota, I'd like to say that the boundaries that are drawn for us may identify us, but they don't necessarily define us. I think it's important that we retain to the best possible effort our cultural demographic uniquenesses, while indeed we strive to work across these boundaries to provide services to one another, as indeed the Minnesota Accountable Government Innovation and Collaboration Act might facilitate us doing. For example, in the Northwest, Beltrami County provides management information systems services for Lake of the Woods County, for Monoman County. Within where I used to apply my other trade as the superintendent of the Northwest Juvenile Center in another public life, 25,000 square miles in the 9th Judicial District from Aiken County on the south-southeast to Kitson and Rosa County on the north-northwest, from Norman and Monoman counties in the south-southeast to Kuchchin County on the north-northeast. And what the biggest thing we have is geography, but we do have certain cultural distinctions, not the least of which are located within this geographic vastness. Great American Indian reservations of Red Lake, Leech Lake, White Earth and Boyce Fort. So indeed, we need to work across these lines, but we do not necessarily wish, I don't think, to obliterate these lines and recognize and know that we could superimpose the entire 10-county metro area right within the 9th Judicial District of northwestern Minnesota. So we got a lot of geography, we got fewer people, but we got social problems, we got public safety answering point things that we are bridging the gap across these lines. But I think that there has to be a way where we can continue to work to provide services throughout the jurisdictions without necessarily obliterating our identities. And that is my comment for you today.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you. Well, I think all of you know that I've been involved with the House Redesign Caucus that started with Representative Marquardt, a bipartisan effort to move forward on finding ways to be more efficient in government. And I thank you, Mr. Aptelli, because we were together at the One Minnesota Conference. I really think that this is a bill that should have been brought before the House Redesign Caucus to get bipartisan support before it was brought through as a bill. There's not one Republican on the bill, which I find kind of frustrating, because we've been really trying hard to work together. And the House Redesign Caucus supported the regional meetings across the state in November, bringing the counties, cities, and township or school districts together to have conversations about how we can work together collaboratively. I understand that we need to be working together. Sharing service is part of it. I don't think this bill is about sharing services. It's about consolidating district counties. So I guess I'm kind of disturbed. I understand the concept, and I'm willing to work with Representative Kahn. But I, like I say, I find it a little frustrating that it hadn't been a bipartisan effort being brought forward if this was a good idea for the state of Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Representative McFarland. I know it's just a study, but Representative Kahn,
well,
you want to address that?
Let me just respond just to that, because I would like to. First of all, when you put a bill in, it is always open for other people to co-author it. And I think there are a bunch of people who added their names to it after the bill was introduced. I don't recall that any of them were Republicans, but no, I don't have. I did go to some of the meetings of the Redesign Caucus, and I certainly think it was a very good idea. And there's no, you know, the reason you put a bill in is to have discussion about things, and the reason, you know, and to have an occasion to bring Mr. Aptelli back again. You know, unfortunately, I couldn't go to that one in Minnesota because I was in another one, and of that conference. So I think, you know, one can clearly talk about how you deal with the cross-jurisdictional issues when you have these jurisdictional lines. And I had a lot more to say about the philosophy of counties and a lot more to say about cross-jurisdictional issues and so forth. This is not exactly a four-page bill that does that all, though. So, you know, I'm comfortable with working on it at this level and changing the, you know, changing the language as appropriate. But I really want to thank the chair for allowing us to squeeze in at this point to just get two people who possibly would not want to come back for further discussion and to have their points of view made. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And is there anybody else that needs to testify today? And then I guess we can have a discussion as to whether we need to have more discussion on this bill or whether we should just move to a vote. And I'd look for feedback on that. Representative Scalzi.
I would just like to say thank you, Ms. Chair, and thanks, Representative Kahn, for bringing this forward. I've been working with Carol McFarland as well, Representative McFarland, on the House Redesign Caucus. And I think there's been such a great amount of effort, and we've worked with the counties. And I appreciate that we have bipartisan support in that caucus. And I just would like this author maybe to work within that caucus, as Representative McFarland has suggested, because I think there's been such a huge amount of effort. And these are very sensitive issues. So I would support Representative McFarland's caucus looking at this.
Representative McFarland?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we could lay this on the table and bring it up at a later date.
Well, that was my original intention, but that was mostly because we were short on time. But if the author is okay with that, we can certainly lay it over. But before we do that, is there anybody else here who would like to testify because they've come from out of town or anything like that? No? Any other questions at this time, since this is the last chance of these two witnesses? No? Okay, with that then, we'll lay the bill over and revisit it later. And thank you, Representative Kahn. Thank you for coming and the two witnesses and testifying. And with that, I don't think there's any other housekeeping. We will adjourn until next week. Thank you.